Accession number 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Reel 5. Now, one thing we haven't really mentioned was the backdrop, and it is only a backdrop, but of the Korean War. Yeah. You knew you were going to Malaya to join
us. Well, once I knew I was going to the Suffolk Regiment, I knew that I would be going to Malaya, because that's where they were. but I was thinking... sorry. I was thinking... talking about the training that we received at Warminster being geared to conventional Northwest European war, that attitude was sharpened, I think, by the onset of the Korean War, which again was, although not, I'm sorry, I was thinking that it confirmed the point that everybody's interest was devoted more to what one might call conventional war than to anti-terrorist war, jungle warfare. And that was certainly the emphasis placed on the course at Warminster.
Anything else about Warminster? I think we may have covered it, but...
No, I don't think so. Not as far as I recall, no.
So where next, then? You finished there about June.
Yep. Had fortnight, 3 weeks embarkation leave, and then sailed from Southampton... for Singapore, bound for Singapore.
Now, what ship were you on?
We were on the Empire Foy, F-O-W-E-Y, which was a German ship that had been taken over by the British and converted to the trooping role.
Now, do you know which month you sailed? Was it June? I think it probably was.
Embarked in Southampton on the Empire Foy on the 19th of June, 1950. Disembarked in Singapore on the 13th of July, 1950.
Now, what were conditions like? What were your cabin? I presume you had a cabin.
I had a cabin which four of us shared, four subalterns. It was my first trip abroad, anywhere really, apart from Ireland. And it was fascinating. We had stewards who looked after us and brought us early morning tea. We ate very comfortably in the officers' dining facility, the dining room or saloon, whatever it was called. It was altogether a very attractive and exciting experience.
What about the troops' conditions? I presume you.
We did.
Were there drafts on board?
Yeah, there were indeed. Yes, and we had a draft of our own soldiers, and we were required to take them on PT exercises and so on in the mornings, whilst on the ship. We also had to do duty officer in turn.
So we got duty officer.
Duty officer was to inspect the lines down in the other ranks accommodation on the ship, and worst of all, to visit soldiers who were in custody on the ship. There was a sort of guard room, and there were cells, and they were at the very front and the very deepest bowels of the ship, and going through the Bay of Biscay. I recall having to inspect and find out if there were any complaints from the prisoners, and I found that very difficult and very hot and very... I couldn't, you know... I suppose they were tougher than I was at that stage, but it was awful. I wasn't sick, but I might nearly have been.
What about the line? What were the conditions like on the mess deck, the soldiers' mess deck?
Soldiers slept, as I recall, in hammocks. I wouldn't be sure they all did. The canteen, the eating facilities were perfectly all right. Again, this is measured against what conditions were like at home in 1949-1950. Certainly would not be acceptable today. But I think, generally speaking, and it was a newly refurbished ship, so that everybody in their own accommodation was fairly satisfied. I don't recall any major criticisms.
Now, what was your? Did you get seasick, or was it only when you went to the
I felt queasy at one stage when we were in the Bay of Biscay. I was not sick, and I was not sick on the whole journey. Some people were, but very few. It was a big ship. I can't remember the tonnage or the number of people it carried, but it was a large ship. We stopped en route at Gibraltar, at Port Said, at Colombo.
Do you remember any of the visits ashore? Because they must have been quite exciting. This must be, you know, for you.
It was exciting. At Gibraltar, we went ashore, went up onto the rock and found the rock apes, that, you know, the traditional thing of whom Churchill said, of which Churchill said, once they go, we lose Gibraltar. That was the only time I went ashore. The other occasions were very brief stops en route to Singapore, and there was no shore leave, as I recall. So that was at Port Said and at Colombo. And we arrived, the one startling thing was we came out of the Suez Canal into the Red Sea one morning, and until then, I mean, we had been in battle dress, and we hit the Red Sea, and it was sweltering hot already, and the order came to change into khaki drill. But it was staggering, the change in temperature, just the transit through the canal from the Mediterranean.
Was khaki drill, I mean, can you explain a bit what it was? Because people, what was khaki drill?
Well, it was a drill, a cotton drill uniform, slacks, designed for wartime. The shirts were a sort of cellulose khaki, as I recall, very lightweight, long-sleeved. The trousers had a double buckle thing. There were two sort of tongues went round the waistline and buckled on the hips, and there was a map pocket in the left leg, rather like battle dress map pocket. Nothing else. We just wore our normal berets and shoes normally, I think, on board the deck.
How did you find that very hot climate when you got through into the Gulf?
Okay, I mean, we were in a very relaxed state, you know, we weren't being put under any sort of physical pressure, so we were able to acclimatise. It was one of the very good things about sailing out to the Far East, that you did have this period of 3 to 3.5 weeks to acclimatise. Later, when I flew to Singapore with my family on a second tour, it was quite a different matter, because the impact was quite fierce on us all, going into a tropical climate. Yes, we. It was more difficult to acclimatise when flying, easy to acclimatise when sailing by troop ship. Having said that, arrival in Singapore was something else, because, of course, the absolute tropical climate of Singapore, the sweltering heat and humidity was again something that one got accustomed to. I mean, I think it probably took easily a month or 6 weeks, but after that one was quite as a young, physically active man, one was quite happy about it.
Now, where were the first battalion Suffolk? When you join them,
at that stage, they were in the Malayan Peninsula, in the southern state of Johor.
Ah, so you didn't join them in Singapore. What happened when you got to Singapore then? Sorry, I've led
you astray. Singapore, we were loaded into trucks, driven to the station. On the platform of the station, we were issued with weapons and live ammunition. It was the first time I'd ever held a pistol in my hands and 12 rounds of ammunition for it, in a sort of non-range situation. Everybody went armed onto the railway. station and into the train, because it was the night train. There were two trains ran from Singapore to Kuala Lumpur. One was a day train and one was a night train. At that time, the night trains were quite frequently ambushed. Reasonably ineffectively, a few shots might be fired. The terrorists did derail a train on one occasion, as far as I remember. I wouldn't know the detail of that, but certainly nothing happened in our case. And so we boarded the night train and chugged slowly out of Singapore station over the causeway from the island of Singapore onto the mainland of Malaya. I mean, Malaya then and not Malaysia as it is today, remember.
And what was the journey like? I mean, these train journeys can be quite evocative of a country. What were your impressions of the
journey? Well, very difficult, because it was pitch black. Nothing. Occasional lights of villages and settlements. Lots of chatter amongst ourselves. No sort of organized preparation to fight off terrorists or anything. And we trundled through the night, and in fact, I think we reached the small town of Segamat in Johor. That's Segamat, Segamat. I should think about 2 o'clock in the morning, where the Suffolk contingent got off the train with all their baggage. We were met by the adjutant, which was a surprise to me. He was there at 2 o'clock in the morning, which the chap called Geoffrey Howjigo, who became a very well-known member of the regiment.
How do you spell Howjigo?
H-O-W-G-E-G-O, Howjigo.
As it
is. Geoffrey Howjigo, yeah.
And what was the reception like?
It was 2 o'clock in the morning. Everybody was worn out and tired, and we were welcomed, and we were led off the platform. There was a fatigue party, I think, there to help with bags and suitcases and so on, and kit bags of the soldiers. We were piled into trucks. I think our draft of men, there were three officers, two National Service officers and myself, and I think there were about 30 soldiers, the draft from Bury St Edmunds. Bundled into a couple of trucks and driven off up to the camp.
And what was the name of the camp?
The camp was not named, as I recall. It was based around a major old government administrative building with tents around it.
What was the nearest town?
Oh, it was in the town of Segamat.
So, right.
Yeah, which you can find on any map. It's a fairly major town in Johor.
Now, what was the setup at the camp? What was the camp like, you know?
It was basically the battalion headquarters. So you had the transport, you had your medical centre, you had the ops room, you had the officers' mess, you had the sergeant's mess, you had a training facility, and I think this was the most important point to make. The rifle companies, A, B, C and D companies, were all on detachment in the area. I suppose the furthest would have been to the south, I think D Company, probably at a small town settlement called Labis, L-A-B-I-S. And they were on detachment away, trying to provide support for the police and doing the very general anti-terrorist activities. We were shown to bedroom. The soldiers were then taken off out of our charge, obviously, and we three subalterns were shown somewhere to sleep, and life began in the battalion from the following morning.
Now, what were your first impressions of the battalion, you know, as a, well, the headquarters of the battalion as a unit?
Everything was new and everything was exciting. It was a totally new life, and we were meeting what seemed like dozens of different people. There weren't so many, in fact, but at the time it felt as though there were lots of people. The commanding officer, Colonel Philip Morecambe, the 2IC, Major Tiny Heal. the adjutant, as I said, Geoffrey Howdigo, HQ Company Commander, Major Leach, the training subaltern, the senior intake into the Suffolk Regiment from Sandhurst post-war, Adrian Gilmore, who remained a firm friend of mine thereafter and still is. He was the subaltern whose job it was going to be to teach the draft and us three officers what the battalion job was about in the jungle.
So how did he go about that, Adrian? He's a lieutenant, I
presume. He's a lieutenant, yes, yeah. I suppose the following morning we were all given an address, and I suspect, I can't recall now, but I think probably the CO spoke very briefly on his way to his office. He sort of would have spoken very briefly to the new draft. And then Adrian Gilmore took over. He had a set of NCOs with him, and we were divided up into sections. The officers, the three of us, were treated the same as the private soldiers with regard to learning all the drills and how to get dressed in your jungle equipment and uniforms and so on, how to store your weapons, how to use your weapons, and then the jungle training program, something like 3 weeks training, culminating in a major patrol exercise.
Now, what were you having to learn then? What was different about jungle? You know, how do they teach you jungle training?
They taught us, first of all, to know how to prepare ourselves physically with our equipment and our rations, etc., to work independently in the jungle. They then taught us to...
How do you do that? In other words, what is it you have to learn that's different?
Well, we hadn't, at any stage in England, at no stage in England was I taught how to put my equipment together with my food to be able to move and live with what I carried on my back for 5 days without replenishment. So that's quite a task. It became a simple task, but to the newcomer, it was quite a task to learn. Then, of course, we had to learn to carry that equipment in jungle conditions. And the jungle is a very difficult place in which to live and work. It's bad enough, jungle itself, but when there is a possibility of an enemy behind every tree, and when you can usually only see 3 or 4 yards in front of you, it is an extremely difficult and threatening environment, and one was being taught to become accustomed to that. Having said that, so we know how to prepare ourselves physically to go off for 4 or 5 days. We then learnt how to move in the jungle itself, and we then learnt a whole...
So how do you move in the jungle?
Well, you move normally in single file, because to move in any other formation is very difficult because of the undergrowth. You have to balance this movement, or perhaps I should start off by saying that everything was geared to section patrol activity. At the stage that I joined the battalion, every company had 2 platoons, and each platoon had 2 sections. And normally one section was commanded by the platoon commander, and the second section was commanded by the platoon sergeant. They rarely went together. Sometimes they did, sometimes even the company went together, but mostly we operated from our base detachment camps as a section at a time. So you don't have any heavy problem about movement, but to go back to your point, you move in single file, except when you think there is any danger of enemy. And the next thing you have to learn, having learned how to move in the jungle, the next thing you have to learn is how to react when you are confronted with an enemy. So the final phase of this 3-week training was, as I said, to learn how to react to the presence of the enemy. He might see you first, you might see him first. And the way that you were trained to react was in following an instant instruction from the patrol commander to adopt a particular formation and a drill. We called these immediate action drills. Going back to the point earlier about it being necessary to respond instantly without question to things, it was critically so in the jungle. If you met an enemy patrol on the same route that you were taking, you would go into extended line and assault straightforward. If you knew there was an enemy moving towards you who had not seen you, you would carry out what we call an immediate ambush drill, where you sank into the side of the track you were on and waited for him to draw level with you and then open fire on the commander's first shot. And so there was a set of these immediate action drills to deal with any eventuality with regard to the enemy.
And we'll be coming to a lot of this when you're actually talking about the actual patrol, so we don't need to get too much.
So that we were drilled and drilled and drilled in this, and finally we went on the culmination of the 3-week training period, jungle sort of preparation period, if you like, before going to our companies, comprised a couple of nights out, as I recall, in the jungle. Not doing any immediate action drills, but just going out and learning to live in the jungle and to sleep at night, if you could, in the jungle. And that was the end. At the end of the 3-week period, we were posted to our various companies.
Now, what did you? Can you talk to me a bit about Gilmore? Because he became a friend of yours. But what was he like then?
He'd very quiet, very laid back, I think. Good sense of humour. He was not a sort of raging ball of fire as one or two of our other subalterns were, but in a sense that was a bit overpowering, and his attitude was excellent. Everybody, I think, totally respected him, soldiers and us new arrivals as officers. And he ran the course very well.
Now, what about, can I just ask you about the colonel? That's Philip.
Philip Morecambe, Morecambe.
Now, what was he like? I mean, did he have? I mean, you were only the most junior subaltern, or one of the most junior. Did you have much contact? What did you think of him? What impression did he make on you?
Very quiet man. An Australian. He went back to Australia when he retired from the army. He gave me huge support in writing the Suffolk Regiment history later on. We had two commanding officers in Malaya during the emergency when we were there from 1949 to 1953. We had a chap called Ian White, W-I-G-H-T, and we had Philip Morecambe. They were totally different characters. I didn't know Ian White particularly well, but I did meet him in later years. He was the man that prepared the battalion to go to Malaya. He was a man of great forceful personality, and he drove the battalion, and he had got them into a high pitch of training, and it was the basis of our success as a battalion in Malaya. His successor, Philip Morecambe, who'd just taken over as I arrived, was a totally different character, very quiet, not a dynamic leader apparently, but a suitable leader for the Suffolk Regiment, and his great achievement was the ability to link the battalion at all levels with the police force, the special branch and the normal desk. He lived in the pockets of the police commissioner, wherever he was. And, of course, we got all the information. We were given all the jobs which came in on the security net and so on through the special branch in the police. So they both had this different way of contributing to our success in Milan.
Now, what about any other key officers? What about the adjutant? How'd you go?
Jeffrey, how'd you go?
Was he a captain?
He was a captain.
What was he like?
He really wasn't like what I came to recognise as a Suffolk officer. He started life off in the Green Jackets, but transferred to the Suffolk Regiment, I think, when we were in Palestine. He was a Suffolk man, but he had that slight difference. He was a very good man, an excellent man, and it was very sad. He died quite young, just after retiring from the army. He reached the full rank of full colonel.
Why wasn't he? What was the difference?
I mean, I don't know. The Suffolk officers could be epitomised by Richard Dick Goodwin, who finished up with General Goodwin. I told you he interviewed me as college commander when I was at Sandhurst. He was a very quiet, gentle man. It always amazed us in the regiment that he could be so quiet and so gentle and yet achieve such great distinction. it was, if I look around at the officers, and I did meet an awful lot of them in the period from 49 to 1959, when the regiment sort of collapsed and amalgamated, there was a gentleness. I don't know whether this is a slightly overstatement, a gentleness to most of them, a quiet, rural thing. And I mean, it's true. I mean, if I look at my photographs, they were generally all like that.
Now, what Major Tiny Heel, he was...
Tiny Heel was called Tiny Heel. He was the second in command. He was called Tiny Heel because he was of enormous stature. He was another one of the gentle ones, but very big. He gave us three subalterns a lecture when we first arrived. He had us in his office. And he said, well, it's good to see you. We're delighted to have you. You'll be wondering where on earth you fit into the battalion. Well, one golden rule, he said, is call everybody sir until you feel comfortable doing otherwise. And so we all complied with that. I thought it was an excellent piece of advice. So we called Adrian Gilmore sir for the first two or three days. Tiny Heel went on not to any great distinction, but he finished up as a full colonel again, and I knew him and his wife through many years.
Any other officers at the headquarters you particularly remember? Or the RSM?
The RSM at that stage was a chap called Windley, who disappeared from view soon after that, and his job was taken over by RSM Duffy, who sounds Irish. He was recruited into the regiment just before the war when it was based in Plymouth, just in the early part of 1939, and he was a West Countryman. And he was a great, great RSM. He had a wonderful sense of humour.
Is it Duffy?
Duffy, D-U-F-F-Y, Duffy.
And what was so good about him?
He had a great sense of humour. He was strict enough. But, I mean, what I'm about to say would epitomise the quality of Duffy. When a patrol had been sent out into the jungle for 5 days, it would normally make a rendezvous, an RV with transport, to be picked up from some roadside by two vehicles. You always travelled with two vehicles in case of ambush by the enemy and so on. It always had to have two escorts, and countless times. I remember RSM Duffy came as one of the escorts, both to demonstrate that he was interested in his soldiers and also to give them a rocket for not shaving for the 5 days they were in, as a joke, I should add. He was just a very warm-hearted, splendid man, almost too warm-hearted to be an RSM, but very good on parade. And so we were blessed with a good man there.